So good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Clearwater Jazz Holiday Foundation's Young Lions Jazz Master Virtual Sessions. Today's educator is John O'Leary, and his topic is What I Love About Jelly Roll Morton. It's part of our newer What I Love About series. Participants are muted upon entry and during the masterclass. We appreciate your cooperation to remain muted for the courtesy of others. If you have a specific question, please feel free to use the chat feature in the toolbar to ask the question, and the educator will try to reserve some time at the end to answer the questions. Also, you can use the raise your hand feature to ask a question, and the moderator will unmute you when educators take questions. We hope you enjoy today's sessions. More upcoming free sessions will be posted at www.clearwaterjazz.com/education. Your feedback and any future session topic suggestions are welcome. Please email info@clearwaterjazz.com. So we want to thank you guys for coming today. And John is not a visitor here at Clearwater Jazz. He's one of our favorites. And some of the past sessions that he shared with us are like history of rhythm section, collaborating among artists with La Lucha, piano technique in jazz, how to develop a language for improvisational piano. This was a good one, how to create melodic lines for improvisation. What I love about Oscar Peterson. I love that one. What I love about Earl Hines. The list goes on and on. But before we start, just want to tell you a little bit about John. John is a Mexican-American jazz pianist and neuroscientist. Wow. He's a pianist for a highly acclaimed trio, La Lucha, in the Tampa Bay area. John has had a wing path. He was born in Yucatan Peninsula, where he started piano lessons at the age of 3. Wow, you're pretty young there, weren't you, John? And he played classical music, classical piano until the age of 12. Once in the U.S., he picked up the tuba and concert band and continued to develop his musicianship through high school, later gravitating to piano, scoring accolades on both instruments. Wow. John attended the University of South Florida, where he studied tuba, jazz piano, and biochemistry. He graduated cum laude with a BA in jazz piano performance, a minor in tuba performance, and an honors thesis in biochemistry. You are a busy guy. John toured Italy and France with the USF Big Band and Jazz Tech Combo. As a member of these bands, he played with many jazz greats, including Randy Brecker and Wyclef Gordon. I know that was a fun gig. As a scientist, John completed his PhD in neuroscience at the University of South Florida, where he is the recipient of the Ruth L. Kirstein predoctoral fellowship from the National Institute of Neurological Disease and Stroke. John has been an invited speaker at the Society for Neuroscience, Midwestern Stress Response, and American Chemical Society conferences. Check out La Lucha's music wherever you stream, and check out their latest release, Everybody Wants to Rule the World. John, the stage is all yours.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you being here, and thank you for having me. It's always an honor to share this with you and with the community here. And thank you for the Clearwater Jazz Holiday for having me. This topic today is What I Love About Jelly Roll Morton. What an incredible guy and a story. His story is wild. Back in the day, life was very, very different than what it is today. And not as much as evident as it is through the story of Jelly Roll Morton. So Jelly Roll, he was born Ferdinand Joseph Lamothe. Born in 1890-ish. They think he was born in 1890, but they're not really sure. And his last name here, Lamothe, I've heard Lamenth and Lamothe. And I've heard In several interviews, Jelly Roll said he was born in 1885, but then the historians think that he was born in 1890, and we don't really know the exact birthday. Some have it as September 20th, others as October 20th, and the exact location of his birth is not sure. Some say like Gulfport, Mississippi, or Gulfport, Louisiana, or in the outskirts of New Orleans. But he grew up in New Orleans, and he was born around 1890-ish. We'll leave it at that. And his parents were Edward Joseph Martin Lamenth and Louise Hermans Monette. His father left his mother, Morton, when Morton was 3 years old, and his mother died when he was 14 years old. So he had a difficult, childhood living in New Orleans. His mother remarried in 1894, and Ferdinand adopted his stepfather's surname, and his stepfather was William Mouton, but he changed it to Morton. Some places say that he anglicized it, but I think the best explanation is that because he used to play in brothels, he didn't want his family or people to trace him back to his family in case there was a problem. So I think he changed his name in order to keep his profession separate from his family. He was part of the Creole community, as he was a mix of African, French, and Spanish. His ancestors, the Peche and the Monettes, were among the city's genteel Creole of color, and they spoke both French and Spanish and valued their education. So Jelly Roll started taking piano lessons around 10 years old, and we knew that he knew how to read and write music because he's one of the first people to write down their compositions in jazz. So his early life here, he is a picture of him as a teenager. When his mother died, along with his two sisters, he went to live with his great-grandmother, Mimi Peche. So Jelly Roll developed this reputation of being one of the best pianists in New Orleans. So I found a reference of as early as 1902 of New Orleans trumpeter Bunk Johnson remembering hearing play Jelly Roll. So, I mean, he must have been 12 to 14, 15, and I think the story goes that he convinced his family, or maybe his grandmother Mimi, that he was working, late at night, doing something else. But here, this quote from Bunk Johnson says that Jelly would sit there and play that barrel house music. A barrel house, the same as a brothel or an adult establishment in the 1900s. And he would play blues and such as that, Bunk Johnson said, which means he played ragtime, he played blues and spirituals, and he was, his family was devout Catholic, and so he probably played church hymns as well. So his arrangement with his great-grandmother didn't last very long. Jelly Roll had been spending his afternoons developing a reputation as one of the top young pianists in New Orleans. And Grandma Peche didn't think music was a suitable career for any family member, let alone playing the piano in Storyville, which Storyville is an establishment that... it was like some 36 or so square blocks of New Orleans that I believe in around 1890 was developed by a councilman, a New Orleans city councilman, Sidney Story. And it had a name, like I think the name was the district. And because the guy's last name who created it was, his last name was Story, they call it Storyville. And so this was a place where prostitution and gambling was legal. And they were trying to prevent the whole city to be full of prostitution and gambling and such things. And so they wanted to limit it to a certain area of the city where it was legal, and you could do it without going to jail or whatever, as long as you did it in Storyville and not outside of those designated area. And the pianist, almost every brothel had a piano and a pianist who played there all night, or different pianists that would go and play there. And the pianists were called professors. And so even from an early age, Jelly Roll was already a professor at one of these barrel houses. And so this is a story from the Jim Cullum radio show, the Riverwalk Collection. And it says, one morning on her way home from Mass, she ran into Jelly Roll, wending his way back after a night working as a piano professor in a brothel. She saw his fancy clothes and knew in a flash what he'd been up to. There's no reason why a 14-year-old, whatever, however old he was wearing fancy, flashy clothes to work all night. He said he was working, and you know, so musicians for Mimi Pesh, musicians were bums and scallywags, and she wasn't about to let Jelly Roll live in the same house with his innocent young sisters and coldly shut him out of the family home. He was 15 years old and out on the street on his own for the rest of his life, whether riding high or hard up for cash. Without fail, Jelly sent money home to his grandmother and the sisters he loved but hardly knew. So first his dad leaves the house, then his mom dies, then he gets kicked out of his grandmother Mimi's house. And at the age of 15, he's completely on his own to figure out what to do. And so this is not like a normal way that people grow up. They grow up, you know, that an ideal way for people to grow up. It might be normal for some people, but it's not an ideal way to grow up. And so you have to grow up really quickly, and you got to be really tough, and you have to find a way to make a living and stay alive. So then what he did is that he went on the road. He took the train to Biloxi and stayed with his godmother, Eulalie Ecod, on the Gulf Coast. And in New Orleans, Creoles often practice voodoo. And Eulalie was thought to be a voodoo queen. Jelly said that he was frightened to see his godmother hold seances and cast spells. So this is a recurring theme in his life, where he has this clash of identity between his Catholic, growing up Catholic, and he went to church, and you know, he went to Mass, and then at the same time there's this voodoo tradition of in the Creole culture. So then Morton started touring in the American South and working in minstrel shows such as Will Benbow's Chocolate Drops. And during this period, he was also composing his songs, Jelly Roll Blues, New Orleans Blues, Frog Eye Moore Rag, Animule Dance, and King Porter Stomp were composed during this period. Stride pianist James P. Johnson and Willie the Lion Smith saw him perform in Chicago in 1910 and in New York City in 1911. So he was moving a lot and touring and just going everywhere. And in 1915, Jelly Roll Blues was one of the first jazz pieces to be published. So let me give you a little a taste of what Jelly Roll Blues sounds like. This is not the original version he recorded. I think the first time he recorded it solo piano. And in fact, I think it came out in a player piano cylinder first. And later on, he had this recording contract with Victor, and he had a band, a really great band, and he came out with this 78. They call it 78 because these records needed to be played at 78 RPMs for you to hear it properly. Today's we have like 45s and 33 and a third, I believe. Okay, so this is Jelly Roll Morton's Red Hot Peppers playing Jelly Roll Blues. Fantastic. So let's talk about his personality. Sharon is paused. Bring your shared window to the front. Hold on. There we go. Something happened there. So part of Jelly Roll Morton's decline in the 1930s was his reputation. And he was a brash and often overconfident person. And he enjoyed telling people that he had invented jazz. And, you know, no one person is credited for inventing jazz. It was a combination of everything, of the African musicians in Congo Square, the African-American church the blues, the Creole music influence. I mean, there's some and some Western music influence as well. And you combine all of that and you get this gumbo, and over time it came out as jazz, but not one person is really credited with inventing jazz. And so between 1910 and 1925, Jelly Roll, he was on his own at a really young age with no parents, nobody to guide him on how to develop, and he just did whatever he could. So he made money playing in honky tonks and roadhouses. He would pull shark, he would gamble, he even was a pimp at some point and was running a string of prostitutes from San Francisco to New York City. And this is a nice quote here from the New York Times that explains the situation. Part of Morton's appeal and part of what led musicians in northern cities like New York to scorn him in the 1930s was his picaresque and almost unimaginably arrogant style. He wore flashy suits, sported a diamond implanted in one of his front teeth, and often told players who were not from New Orleans that their music was pitifully inadequate. So, can you imagine this guy with a diamond on his tooth? That's pretty wild. That's incredible. At the same time, he was a genius, and he was one of the first musicians to start arranging for jazz, for this idea of writing something down the specific that you wanted, and then creating sections of improvisation and having a form to the music, very much like marches have forms. And so this was not done before him. And so he was very much an innovator, and his music, especially the music that came out in the 1920s, is considered masterworks in jazz today. So the high point of his career was in the 1920s. In 1923, Morton moved to Chicago and he began his recording career. And think about all the people who were in Chicago in the 1920s playing jazz. King Oliver, Louis Armstrong, you had Jelly Roll Morton, and then people from New York would go and check out, see what's going on. And also Earl Hines was in Chicago, I believe, and that's how he met Louis Armstrong. And so Chicago in the 1920s was the place for jazz. If jazz was born in New Orleans, it grew up in Chicago. And so when he moved to Chicago, he started his recording career. He made his mark that year with a series of brilliant piano solos among the most significant in jazz up to that point, including King Porter Stomp, Grandpa Spell, Kansas City Stomps, The Pearls, Shreveport Stomp, Jelly Roll Blues. And this is all music that he wrote, including the Wolverine Blues. And in 1926, Morton signed a contract with the Victor Talking Machine Recording Company. And you had seen earlier one of those 78s that he made. And he had the opportunity to bring a well-rehearsed band to play his arrangement in the Victor Recording Studios in Chicago. Now, this is very rare. People didn't have a chance to have time to write and rehearse and bring everything prepared. It was usually like, come and play, and that was it. And so a lot of jazz up to that point was improvised, and there wasn't really the chance to write complicated things and rehearse it and then play them, So these recordings by Jelly Roll Morton and his Red Hot Peppers included Kid Ory, and I believe Kid Ory played in with Louis Armstrong in some of the Hot Fives and Sevens recording. There's Omar Simeon, George Mitchell, Johnny Saint Cyr, Barney Bigard, Johnny Dodds, Baby Dodds, and Andrea Lair. These are considered masterworks in jazz today, and he's a poster, or I believe is the cover of a publishing of Jelly Roll Blues. So there are absolute classics, indisputably, said James DePaugny, a professor of music theory at the University of Michigan, who is also a composer, pianist, and band leader. They're miracles of organization and artistry. It's not so much that any one person on them is so fabulous, as you might say for Armstrong at the time, but because the way he used an ensemble was absolutely unprecedented. Whether he actually invented jazz, as he often claimed, is and will always be debatable. Beyond much doubt, however, he was the first serious jazz composer, the first to write multi-themed pieces and develop a distinctive jazz style. So here's a picture in 1926 of Jelly Roll and his Red Hot Peppers. You see Morton at the center, with Omer Simeon, Andrew Allaire, John Lindsay, John St. Cyr, Kid Ory, George Mitchell, and all but Mitchell were from New Orleans. How cool is that? And that was a big thing for him, that the proper way to play jazz was to do it the way that it was done in New Orleans, and everything else was kind of an imitation of that. And so here is an example of another piece that he wrote called The Wolverine Blues. This is a piano solo with clarinet and traps. Thank you. Yeah. You already see from this recording that the emphasis is already on two and four in this music, which till today in swing and in jazz, the strong beats are two and four. It's pretty amazing how much of the music was already there during this time. In 1930s, while Morton moved to New York in 1928, he continued to record for Victor and recorded tracks such as Kansas City Stomp and Tank Town Bump. He recorded with a bunch of people, including Sidney Bechet in New York during this time. He remained true to his New Orleans roots, producing music that gradually came to be viewed as old-fashioned within the industry. During the 1930s, he started going more towards the big band era, and swing and dancing. And Morton's music fell out of the limelight and struggled to earn a living during the bleak times of the Great Depression. So his New York sessions failed to produce a hit, and due in part with that and the Great Depression, Victor did not renew his contract in 1931. So in 1935, his 30-year-old composition, King Porter Stomp, was arranged by Fletcher Henderson and became Benny Goodman's first hit and a swing standard. But Morton did not receive any royalties from those recordings. And unfortunately, that was typical of the time. Here you see later on, he went back and was doing some more work for RCA Victor. This, I believe, is in 1939 during his second Bluebird recording session. And maybe they were just doing at those studios for Bluebird. Yeah, so that's interesting. So, like many musicians of color, he was denied membership in ASCAP, and the organization that collects royalties. That's the organization that collects royalties for composers. There's BMI, there's CSAC today. But oddly, ASCAP did collect royalties on his music, but never turned them over to him. Publishers who distributed Morton's later sheet music, notably the Chicago-based Melrose Brothers, also cheated him out of his financial due. He wrote dozens of protest letters to state and federal prosecutors, but got nowhere. Here is a the King Porter Stomp. I think, his earlier stuff with the Red Hot Peppers really put him on the map as a as an arranger, as a writer, and he had lots of really great compositions, and he was not a flexible person. He was not able to adapt with the times of what was going on the way, like, for example, other musicians were able to do, and go from the New Orleans era to the 1930s and then to the bebop era. And so I think he died in like 1941 and wasn't able to recuperate the status that he had in the 1920s. But his music lived on, and now he's recognized as one of the founding fathers of jazz. And here is a video of King Porter Stomp arranged by Fletcher Henderson for the Benny Goodman Orchestra. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much. And that is my presentation on jelly, what I love about Jelly Roll Morton.
Thank you so much, John, for sharing all this great information on Jelly Roll. And he's certainly one of the greats. We have a couple questions here that came.
Yeah.
So how were the ensembles during that day? We hear about Storyville and things like that, New Orleans. What was a common ensemble during that time? Was it more of a small combo? Was it more of a big band, or was it a mixture? What type of ensembles did he play with most of the time?
That's a good question. Most of the time, Jelly Roll played by himself. He played in the ragtime style or the blues or spirituals or hymns and music, minstrel music from minstrel whatever they're called, and from whatever was popular in the day. I mean, he was they if you go to a club, they play the club music today, right? The boots and pants and boots and pants and whatever is popular in the radio. And but back then, it was the there weren't we didn't have radios. Those places didn't have these high fidelity stereos, and so it was the pianist. The cheapest way was to get pay one guy, and they used a professor to go and play. And so, but when he had his band, he had the cornetist George Mitchell, he had the trombonist Kid Ory, clarinetist Omer Simeon and Johnny Dodds, he had the banjoist Johnny St. Cyr or Bud Scott, and sometimes they had a double bass. John Lindsay, or drummers Andrew Allaire or Baby Dodds. And other times they had a tuba player. But that was, I mean, if you're talking like the typical New Orleans thing, it was a trombone, cornet, and clarinet, right? And the cornet played the melody, and the second voice was by the clarinet doing most of the improvising, and then the third voice was the trombone, being able to weave in and out of what the other two players are doing. And sometimes there was drums or traps, as they were called back then, and there were it wasn't like the drum set that we know today. It was a lot more minimal in that time, and but there was banjo and piano, and yeah, and sometimes tuba, and instead of bass, and the bass players usually you can't hear it because they didn't have amplifiers, and so. But usually that's like the typical instrumentation of those bands. But normally, most of the time, pianists of that era would play by themselves.
Great, great. I'm glad you mentioned how this was a way of life for them. They didn't just play on the weekends and things like that.
No, they played like three sets a night.
A night. So
So
imagine.
five, six nights a week, like they were. They were playing from midnight to 6 in the morning, sleep all day, wake up at 4, eat, and then play, like do it all over again,
Yeah, and that's amazing. These days, sometimes it's hard to be a full-time musician, but that was their way of life. That's how they ate. I think another question was, how was the relations, if you can answer this one, how was the relations between, say, this genre of music and classical at that time? We hear so many stories about they even wanted to outlaw jazz, in the beginning.
Yeah,
So,
absolutely.
not quite understood. It wasn't tame. It wasn't part of
No.
the norm with the European, you know, or French influence. So could you elaborate a little bit on that if you can?
Yeah, absolutely. Jazz or New Orleans music is primarily is music that came out of the Black community and Black culture. This was because of slavery and because of the way and you know, after the Civil War, you know, it was within, I think during the presidency of Andrew Johnson, it quickly became back to what it was before. And he tried to roll back what Lincoln was trying to do. And so before you know it, you had the Jim Crow era. And it was for many years, people were still working in plantations and people were still suffering. And in many ways, they still are today. And so that played a huge role, because if you were enjoying or participating in that music, you were associating with Black America. And so it wasn't proper. It was devil music, and the blues were devil music, and the proper music was classical music. And but you know, that's what they've been saying that about music forever. When in the 17th century or 16th century, whenever they started using dominant chords, they heard that interval, you know, the raised fourth, and said, whoa, that's the devil's interval, right? We got to avoid using dominant sevens because that's the devil's music. And then people eventually got used to it. And little by little, part of it is biologically, you know, you're not, these things sound strange. If you went to a person who's never heard music before and just start playing Charlie Parker, they're going to go, what is, I've never heard any music ever. I'm, you know, like people who still live in those hunter gatherer tribes. And part of it was just the ability to tolerate dissonance. And, you know, Western music was pushing that forward throughout the 18th and 19th century. And, you know, by the time we get to the 20th century, you have Schoenberg and in the middle 20th century, Stravinsky and whatnot. And so it was about status, and there was, you know, the status is always about putting people down. And that was one way that they could feel better about themselves. And so that's my two cents on that. So I think without the incredible racism that was part of American everyday life, there, I don't think we would have jazz.
I agree. And it's, you can just trace through the history of jazz and see how it's played a part in whether it's protest or just breaking.
Absolutely.
This genre has been there just about the whole way, and it's made right here in America. It's infused with so many cultures and
exactly.
So
it's multicultural, but multicultural in the Black community, you know, between Mississippi Delta blues or blues, or you know, everywhere that blues was played, and the, you know, the Baptist church and you know, mixed people like the Creoles and different you know, mixes of African with different cultures Western cultures, and they had different music, and Creoles had more access to education because of their lighter skin, and so many of them were trained to read and write music and to read and write in different languages, like Jelly Roll's family was, So,
So, thank you so much for that answer. I do highly recommend anybody that's joining us today, whether you're a beginner at in music or you're an expert, you're a pro player, continue to research and do your history on this music, because it's so rich with culture, and it's broken
indeed.
so many boundaries. So, and we
Yeah.
also want to charge you to tell other people about what's happening here with Clearwater Jazz Young Lion virtual sessions. Remember, you can always go back and see past sessions. Go to our website, www.clearwaterjazz.com/education. And if you have any suggestions or topics you'll love here, just email us at info@clearwaterjazz.com. John, we want to thank you for your time today and all the research. We really enjoyed the session today and learning so much about Jelly Roll Morton. And we're excited to go continue to support this music. And we can't wait to the next one. So thank you so much for your time. And we thank you thank everyone for coming out today. And we will certainly see you here at the next one.
Oh, thank you so much. Really appreciate you hosting and having me, Michael. And thank you to the Clearwater Jazz Holiday for allowing me to be a part of this wonderful series.
Awesome. Have an awesome day, everyone. We'll see you at the next one.
See you the next one.
Thank you for listening to Clearwater Jazz Holidays Young Lions Jazz Master Virtual Sessions. Thank you to our friends at Marine Max Clearwater for helping to present this podcast series. To learn more about the Clearwater Jazz Holiday Annual Festival tradition, other special events throughout the year, and our year-round education and outreach, please visit clearwaterjazz.com.